Are you ready? Why don't you close the door so we don't pollute the sanctity. First of all, unabashed self-promotion. There's a interview. It was broadcast Friday by a woman named Ingrid Cummings. I don't know if anyone knows her. She's got a show on WICR. Rubicon Salon, and it was already broadcast, but I taped it and I stuck it up on my website if you want to listen. She did just a wonderful job, otherwise I wouldn't think it's worth it. But if you go to jgsparks.net, it's one of those secret spots, then you just go / Rubicon, R-U-B-I-C-O-N, Salon, S-A-L-O-N, no space, and a capital R and a capital S.
Can you do that one more time?
JGSparks.net / then capital R U B I C O N.
Goes right together, right?
Right. And then capital S A L O N. I don't know if I'm supposed to do that or not, but I did. It's supposed to be available on the WICR website, but it's not, so I figured heck with it. So that's what I made you, Mary. I made you a copy of that.
Thank you.
It's just that I was, you know, you get used to questions like, well, what's it mean if you dream in color? But she really asked thoughtful questions, so I was really pleased. And I, you know, give a plug for tonight for the friends of you.
Is she a professor? Or?
She teaches at IUPUI. She writes for Indianapolis Monthly. And she has this radio show. So she's kind of a master of jack of all trades.
Master of none.
But she was thoughtful in the interview, so I was really pleased. I don't know if she'll be at the Friends of Young tonight or not, but she is all introduce you guys to her. She's really thoughtful. And I gave a whole plug for us. I gave about 15 minutes for the Friends of Young, but they cut that out. And it's supposed to be on what they call a podcast. But that's not up and running on their website, so I guess it got cut out. Last time we talked a lot, and it was and is very important, I feel, this bit about Jung's taking as a starting point, Jung's Kant's epistemological criticism of religious knowledge. Namely, that there is no such thing, that there is only religious experience, and whether or not that experience coincides with the object experienced is a matter of doubt for Jung and Kant, on the basis that how can the finite know the infinite if an ant can't know the bigger? That's kind of putting it in a nutshell. Somebody came up to me after the class and said, well, that's all very nice, but what's a religious experience? So I thought, well, that's a fair question. What's a religious experience?
You're asking us to
do. Yeah. No, I think we all have our own versions of it, but...
To describe it, I mean...
Yeah, well, I mean, if you had one, you want to talk about it? Yeah, if you want to generalize from the experience, if you don't want to...
Well, the first thing that came to my mind is Jung's quote about what a religious experience is. Whenever something crosses one's willful path that interferes for good or bad, and, you know, but that actually, now, that takes some time to come to that place where that becomes a religious experience. For one, I guess for me, synchronicity is.
Yeah.
For example, when my husband died, everything just fell into place. Mm-hmm. It was just absolutely such a remarkable experience, from the death to the service to just how things fell together, the readings and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was a very sacred and religious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can make them.
You want another one about synchronicity?
Yeah.
My brother-in-law died of cancer, and the morning that they called us to tell us that he had cancer, which we didn't even know he was sick, when we got up, we noticed across the street that in our neighbor's yard, this big, beautiful, healthy tree had just fallen over.
Oh, my gosh.
And we got a really sick feeling in our stomach because we're used to these sort of experiences. Mm-hmm. And then about an hour later, we got the phone call.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
I think the language of mysticism is appropriate here, sort of a sense of unity, a feeling of appropriateness somehow, that all is right in the world, that somehow whatever I was doing, which was basically just sitting still, was just enough. And it was in somehow being in touch with an energy and a coherence that was not of my doing or of my making, but of my acceptance, I guess would be the way of saying it. And it had absolutely nothing to do with dogma in a book or speech or language. It was an intensely felt experience of a connection.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good with the natural world. The natural world somehow had a living quality to it that was intelligent and coherent beyond anything of my ability to make of it or do with it. It just of its the thing in itself and coherence and intelligence.
I'll tell you some of my experiences. Quite frankly, the first one was on LSD. And I saw God and she's purple.
Yeah.
All the best ones are.
I was in the Glacier National Park, and I saw there was that purple mist permeating everything. And I thought, oh, that's God. I had two experiences like that without any drugs when I was in the Peace Corps. One, I was with a friend. And we hiked back into the middle of nowhere and climbed up a burial mound and overlooked a village that probably hadn't changed since the time. I mean, they were thatched huts around a well, about 10 huts, no electricity. They pulled the water up by a bucket. And I said, so we had a picnic lunch, and I said, so what are we going to do here all day? And she said, listen to the wind. And it's the first, it was that sort of experience again of a being beyond or among. The third, strangely, was I was out, again in the Peace Corps, out with a hike, hiking with a bunch of guys, and we stumbled onto a grotto. And there must have been a Buddhist service just ended because all the candles were still lit and all the stone seats were warm. And that same experience was there. Since then, I think synchronicity has become what I feel expresses that. I mean, in other words, I haven't had those, if you want to call them mystical experiences, since then. But this feeling, certainly in my own personal life and watching other people's development, that there's something else going on. We're really important, but there's something else going on, and it behooves us to cooperate with it. So that's been my experience. Apropos LSD, if you happen to think I'm all for drugs, some of you know this story, I went to Zurich then, and one of my first dreams was that a Japanese woman was brought to me, and she was covered head to toe in third-degree burns. And I had to heal her. And my analyst said, have you ever done LSD? I said, yeah. And she said, a lot. I said, yeah. He said, that's what LSD does to the soul. It's too much light too fast. Burns the soul. You know, I think it's one of the tragedies of our time that for somebody like myself, I mean, I was a relatively responsible individual. That was the only way in there. I mean, I'd gone to church, I'd, you know, all this other stuff, but I had never had access to this other dimension until I took drugs. and I don't anymore. Never will again, I don't think. Nothing of that magnitude. And for me, it's become a much more quiet sense that something else is guiding. And I am very important in that process, but without what that process brings me, my efforts would never succeed. Why are the right opportunities there just when I need them? So that's my 2 cents. Anybody else want to throw in theirs?
Plus, you had a dream where, you just indicate, psychology, but you just shake uncontrollably. But at the same time, I was scared half to death, but then at the same time, I knew that I wasn't going to get hurt. And then I knew in a way it was the Holy Ghost and Mary.
I think that's my purple. Because Mary has that purple robe. Blue purple robe. No. You've studied too much Jung. You've studied too much Jung.
Mary, can I offer a modest amplification of your story? That the Swiss scientist who synthesized lysergic acid diethylamide in April of 1945, it was the same year, I believe, as major breakthroughs were made regarding the atomic bomb. And so it was interesting that in the outer world, the expression of the force, and the inner explosions and expression that happened in the force of nature. And then the scarring that your, the burns, the third degree burns that your character and your dream came up with. That seems kind of interesting to me. But it's interesting that both those sort of things happen at the same time. And then the explosive use of that particular chemical did provide tremendous insight for a lot of people that have religious experiences. Some people went off and studied in ashrams and gurus and stuff and put drugs behind, but it provided a sort of a catalyst for many people. Well, for many of us to get into other things.
And Nagamati, same thing.
Oh,
1945.
Yeah. Wow, that's a trifecta. Okay, what's the fourth? What was Jung doing then? I'm sure there's some.
I have to see what he was doing then. And Nagamati is full of Sophia, so.
Richard Tarr, who's done a lot of work with who's the birthing guy?
Straw.
Yeah. He studied the LSD, and they got interested in why some people had a good trip and some people had these very frightening trips.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ultimately able to connect it to the person's astrological chart.
Yeah.
And during certain astrological pictures, you could predict that it was going to be the purple goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Experience and other charts would be the horrific experience, being attacked,
paranoid.
There's a complete correlation between the two.
Yeah, I never had a bad experience, and then one day I said, I'll quit while I'm ahead. never went back.
I had my stars read when I was pregnant, and she said, you cannot need drugs. And I got paranoid even off of marijuana. So she said, do not do, because of, and it was just like, well, I sort of knew that. I do real well.
The stars are affirming.
Yeah, whole theory there.
The older I get and the more I study, the more in touch I get with the symbology as far as a religious experience.
Yeah.
For example, just a real simple thing, but one of the things I've been working on is letting go. And the other day, how you'll just see all these gorgeous leaves falling and letting go, and there's no wind, there's really kind of no reason for them to be falling, no physical reason. And it's just like, it was just another sign for me that was a symbol of this work, inner work.
Yeah.
And those to me.
I'm with you 100% on that,
or a picture I'll see it. Or that I'll be looking for something and all of a sudden it will be.
Yeah, I would say, for me, it started out like chugging whiskey, and now it's like sipping wine.
Well, I had an experience last summer that was, I didn't even know what it was, but we were taking the ferry from Nantucket back to Cape Cod, and sitting at a table with another woman who was very talkative, and my husband was very nice to her and everything. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore, so I went out on the deck, and just all of a sudden, I was totally emptied. It's the strangest feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no control over that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt very special.
Mm-hmm. I think that is characteristic of our time, the sacredness of emptiness. And that's the shift. It used to be the sacredness of fullness,
mm-hmm.
and now it's the sacredness of emptiness. Yeah.
Has anybody had a religious experience inside the church?
Yeah.
Really?
Go ahead.
I think it's important to hear this.
Well, I don't know whether this was a religious experience on a white man. It was just last Sunday. And I was there, and it was like something went over my head that was neither skin or fabric, but something in between.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that meant. Do you?
No.
It wasn't a hot flash.
I don't know.
Well, it's like an invisible net of some sort.
Mm-hmm. It was almost just covered my face like skin.
Hmm.
Only it wasn't.
Well, it was
neither
right
skin
then.
Nor fat. But I just thought, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, but I have no idea.
You would consider that a religious experience?
I don't know. It might have been. Who knows? I don't know what it was. You know. It was an experience, just put it that. Because I was very conscious of that happening, you know.
Don't you think any experience that really moves you?
For me, it's become hooked up with guidance. But my earlier ones weren't. My earlier ones were just aesthetically overpowering and emotionally, I don't know what to say, positively crushing. But now they've become connected with guidance.
One of my early religious group, I think, kind of just came in a roundabout way. I never thought of it until you mentioned it. I was in undergraduate education towards the chemistry, and I was having great difficulty with this one mathematics course. And I went home one weekend, and I never talked to my father about how I was doing in this course, that course. And I was a blue young, and he looked me firmly in the eyes and said, "How are you doing this work?" And I normally don't discuss issues that whether I'm having this problem or going well, or if I didn't make an A, I wouldn't have mentioned. And somebody just said to me, "Tell him that you're not doing well in this work." Because I normally would not do that. And I told him. And he said, "I'll pray on it." And then I went back to take the following exam. And I declare he had blue flag. ABC. I mean, everything. It was the simplest test that I thought could be composed. And I had been doing rather poorly. And then, I still was skeptical about the whole thing, and I was not going to mention it when I went back the second time home. I was just going to leave it, you know, like, that's just something that happened. He looked me straight in the eye and said, "How did you do in that math class?" He said, "I prayed for you." And it really woke me up about how things are going on out there and what prayer is involved with.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
But I meant to say, because you mentioned, because I was really thinking that maybe chemistry was not my thing. You know, maybe I wasn't smart enough to do the mathematics and all that is necessary. And that made me think that, yeah, I should go on in that. That's what made me think that. It convinced me that I should go on in that.
Sandy?
I was somewhere between First Communion and Confirmation, and that's 7 and 10, so somewhere in there. My mother was Catholic, and she was raising me Catholic, and so we went to Mass one Sunday, and I have no idea what happened, but I saw her leaving the pew of the church, and she was talking to a friend, and they were, so she went on thinking I was in behind her, and then I'm not sure exactly what happened. I don't remember anybody talking, you know, voices or anything like that. But I don't know how long, it must have been at least 10 minutes that she was out there, and finally she came back in and saw that I was sitting there in the pew, sitting there. And so she called out my name, and it just kind of like, whoa, okay, so I was back. And what happened was that, as I've gone through it in years past, it felt like a religious experience between that mystery, God, Goddess, Sophia, whoever you want to call it, and me. And that there was no longer the mediary of the church for me. That I had a one-on-one experience, and that was the most important thing in my life. And because I remember when I was confirmed then, it was so shallow, and so it was like, what? You know, like, you give me a little tap, you know. And I wanted to go, belt me, baby. Anyway, no, because of the experience that I'd had was so powerful. So anyway, and that was really the beginning of my leaving the church, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Religious experience propelled you away from the church.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
I think it's happened for a lot of people.
I'm sure it has.
Yeah. And it has the spiritual experience.
Right.
Not necessarily the experience of the church.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it had nothing to do with the church. It was one and one. I do know that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want to, you know, not leave any stones unturned. So thank you all.
Question,
pardon?
So with Job's experience,
oh, definitely. Yes.
And that was not necessarily
hard. Right. That's the big shift.
Mm-hmm. Some of my biggest ones have not been hard.
Yeah.
Right. The ones that really took me down a different path, changed my life, you know, that I absolutely hated. Mm-hmm. Help her it over, but those have been, in hindsight, the very things that changed who I was. The others are nice.
And and I'd like to say that the analytic work for me is very, very spiritual. Uh-huh. I don't want to say religious. It's deeper than that for me. Yeah, it's always spiritual. And continues.
Thank you all. I have to correct myself. I don't know where I read it. I read it somewhere, but I was wrong about the interpretation of dreams in Freud and seven copies. It wasn't much better. He sold 800 copies in 6 years. So, but there was one of his books, and I tried to find that which one, that either sold 7 or 17. I don't remember what it was, but I was wrong on that. Schopenhauer. I'm just now picking up loose ends from last time. Is there any extra sheets, or?
If you could tell me what page that is, I'd like to go.
12 and 13. 12 and 13. I thought I made enough for everybody. 1, 2. Maybe not. I didn't bring one for myself, I don't think. Maybe I could just look off of yours for a moment. honestly, I'm not really interested in this. But
that's why you didn't bring one.
That's probably why I didn't bring one for myself.
I probably not either.
But it's a worthwhile question. What did Jung gain from Schopenhauer? And Edinger gives a really concise description. And I thought if anybody wants to follow up on it, they're welcome to and give a report to the class. And I'll just read you what. What he says. Let me starting with Kant. For the sake of completeness, here I am on about halfway down on page 12. For the sake of completeness, there were four figures subsequent to Kant who assisted in developing psychological empiricism and who influenced Jung. Kant discovered the forms and categories of the mind. That's what we talked about. That those, that our perceptions are shaped by our mind. Therefore, psychological statement, religious statements say as much about our mind as shaper of experience as it does of the object experienced. Does that sound right to everybody? Well, the Kant's big thing is that our perceptive system is what shapes our experience. So we're talking about religious experience. What we're looking at is a composite of whatever experience is as shaped by our own capacity for experience. It's filtered through human categories, might be a way to put it. That's why we said that religious experience is a description of our psychology as much as it is a description of God. Hopefully that's what we talked about last time. Kant discovered that the forms and categories of the mind of subjectivity that serve to structure experience and established the fact that it is impossible to know the nature of the thing itself. All that we can know is the psychic representation. So how do we all know that what you're seeing, what I'm seeing, are the same thing? We have no way of knowing that what it works because it's parallel. But I have no idea. You might be seeing what I see red is blue, and what I see blue is red, and so on. These subsequent figures further develop epistemology toward a phenomenology of the psyche, meaning that you, what you know is your experience, without yet recognizing the unconscious as an entity or yet having a notion of an empirical method as entree to the unconscious. Now, Schopenhauer, following Kant, applied Kant's ideas, but thought he discovered the thing in itself. His major work was entitled The World as Will and Representation. His idea was that the individual human being could know the thing in itself by virtue of his own inner experience. It was Schopenhauer's conclusion that the thing in itself was will, a dynamic towards existence. It would be a kind of philosophical version of libido, unconscious libido. For Schopenhauer, All the representations which go to make up the inner and outer world with which we are familiar are representations of the will, the cosmic will. It's not real clear.
Well, it seems metaphysical.
I guess, if I were to try to paraphrase that everything is a form of energy. And in knowing the thing, we know the energy, and that is like a layer below the form of the thing. I'm not sure that's real important for our purposes, but he gives then where Jung discusses that, and I gave you the references for what 1971, 66, and 30, 63 BR. If anybody wants to follow it up and flush that out, that's why I said I didn't really have the energy or interest in doing that. But I think...
Is that on book one of their collective binds?
Let's see, 1971 is Psychological Types.
Okay.
1966 is two essays on... the Psychological Types is volume 6. Two essays is volume 7. 1963B is Memories, Dreams, Reflections. You're welcome to do your work and present it and make that more clear. I think basically what it's about is, basically what Jung got from it is that there is this great drive in the universe, and that is Schopenhauer's way of what Jung is talking about as energy, which is not qualitative. For Freud, energy is qualitative, namely sexual. And Jung says energy is just energy. It doesn't have to have any particular quality to it. And I think that's the link. And then what we have to do is try to get to know that. So if you want to pursue that further, be my guest. So just a quick review from last time, if you're all right with that. The two big ideas were the impossibility of metaphysical knowledge and the psychological nature of all religious experience. And I alluded to a quote which I found. By the way, I've taken everything that is relevant to this theme and put it up on my website. If you go to jgsparks.net and then you click on quotes, and there's a link. There's a link there to, I think it's called Psychology and Religion. And I'm going to update it with some of the things we've talked about here too. But might be more accurate to call it the Psychology of Religion. But and you know, I noticed how, of course, I know how offensive that is to some people, what I've just said. But and they will say, oh, you know, you're psychologizing religion and all that stuff. But as I said also, I think, now if we step back from that, it is time to integrate Christianity. We are now in a position to psychologically form a relationship to the Christian story, like we are capable of understanding Greek myth as symbol. And so in that sense, what Jung is doing is profoundly in the service of Christianity, but in the evolution of Christianity. And the quote I referred to is this one. The subsequent stage of religious thought is always the interpretation on the subjective stage. So there's a religious revelation that is taken as metaphysical truth. Doubt sets in. And when that happens, that means that that religious system is now capable of being integrated, that we can find the meaning in our own life of all the different aspects of the Christian story. And that's what he means by interpretation on the subjective stage. And the subsequent stage means subsequent to the original belief in the religious system. And then what's going to happen, I suggested, is there'll be a new revelation. And, you know, if you look at the history of civilization, that is not so weird, that there are, you know, Judaism became Christianity. Why are we thinking Christianity cannot become something else? Hinduism became Buddhism. And I think we're very much in that time of integrating what was once believed, and then what comes next? Well, we won't know it probably, but it will be, we are preparing the way for future generations to have a new religious myth. That's my view. So all that's on my website if you want to look. Psychology and Religion. Then the two dreams we talked about were Nishina taking the Chinese girls over the mountain. I think Carol helped us there a lot by pointing out that the southern side of the mountain is the Yang, which would mean that they're getting more power. And that was in response to Pali's obsessing about this business, can God be conscious? And that sounds like a very academic discussion until you realize, now applying what we just said, that discussions or descriptions of God are really descriptions of our own psychology. So when Pali says God can't be conscious, that means he can't be conscious. And that's where we left off. Questions? I thought what I'd do now is put in a slight detour. We're coming up to the chapter on Job, and I thought, but the dreams that are following where we are between now and the beginning of that chapter really would, our understanding really would benefit if we were sure we understood what the book of Job was about. So I thought I'd take a little time rather than do it now, rather than do it when we get to the book of Job. to set the stage for what is the Book of Job and what does Jung make of it. And if you know this, stop me. I won't pursue it if you don't. If you're comfortable with it. So first I'll tell you the story, then I'll tell you what Jung makes of it very simply, and then I've picked out maybe 10 quotes from Edinger's work on Job, just to get us really thorough. So we're kind of doing groundwork in Jung's view of religion. We've done Kant and religion. We've done namely the impossibility of metaphysical knowledge. We've done the psychological nature of religious statements. Now we'll look at the Book of Job. Because Pali is now going to start wrestling with religious questions. And if we don't know the background of Jung's interpretive tissue, I think we'll lose a lot of what the value is here. So the basic thing about the Book of Job is Job makes a pact with the devil. And the devil says... God makes a pact with the devil. God makes a pact with the devil. And the devil has said to God, the only reason Job is faithful is because things are going well. So let me beat him up and you'll see. Now the other big detail here is this is the only place in the Bible where Leviathan and Behemoth appear in the same book. Leviathan and Behemoth are, I forget which is which. Leviathan's, I think, a sea monster, and Behemoth's a land monster. And they're these mean monsters. So that's all in the prologue, or that's all in the beginning. And then, so, Yahweh says, go ahead. So, Satan, destroys Job, kills his children, all that stuff. And, Job keeps saying, I'm innocent. What are you doing? And of course, then all his pals come and say, no, God really knows better. You must recant because you've done something wrong. And Job says, I haven't done anything wrong. And it keeps up until finally Job recants. And he says, you're right. Okay, I give up. And then Yahweh, realizing that Job is faithful, restores his property and his prosperity. The traditional interpretation of that is that it shows that Job's acquiescing shows that the message of the book is really that God does know better, and if you can let go of your hubris then and cooperate with God, then you have got the main point. And Jung's response to that is, well, now, what are you supposed to say when you're looking down the barrel of a howitzer? That is no moral victory for God. That is moral shame for God that he allowed this bestial treatment of Job. And Job's recanting has nothing to do with the story. It was the only thing he could do to preserve the shred of life that he had. And the real point of that book is the integrity with which Job stood his ground in the midst of adversity and said, I am not guilty. My judgment is at least as good as yours, God. As a result of that, now this is Jung's interpretation, God realized that he was up against somebody who was morally superior to himself and felt guilty. The other detail that Jung goes to is the presence of Behemoth and Leviathan as representing God's bestialness in allowing this whole drama to go on. As a result, then, Jung says the real answer to Job is in the following books in the Bible, and Proverbs. And that's the first time we hear of Sophia. So what the book of Job, what Job's or integrity to his own sense of honesty was that it got God in touch with Sophia. And Sophia then is the wisdom of God that God had always had around, but as Jung said, forgot to consult. So that Job's consciousness initiates a change in God. That's the whole point. Where God becomes moral. And as a result, incarnated in Jesus Christ. So the real answer to Job is Christ. Through Job's not accepting guilt and standing up to God, God began to reflect. Now, however, the birth of Christ creates another problem, and that is Yahweh went from one side to the other and made himself all good. And the devil was excluded. And Luke, forget what it is, Luke 8, Jesus says he sees Satan fall from heaven. And Jung takes that as God now can no longer face his own shadow. He realized he's done wrong. He tries to be good, but all, which is a development, but the problem is at the expense of awareness of his shadow. And so that has created a civilization, now going with the idea that the religious story is a psychological story, has created a civilization which cannot look at its own shadow. And if there's ever a civilization that could look at our shadow, it's been the Christian one. Which brings us up to today, that we are all now faced with looking at that Satan that was cast out 2,000 years ago. And in doing so, we will initiate a new transformation of God, like Job initiated a transformation of God earlier. Which is another way of saying what I just said, that by looking at the psychology of the Christian myth, we are preparing the way for a new revelation. But the big idea there is that you have a say in the state of the God image. And our task is to live in a way that makes it more moral.
What did you say? The person has a part in the state?
In the condition, right. I'll go through that in a second, a little bit more. Yeah.
We talked about from time to time the amoral outlook of the psyche.
Yeah.
How's that fit?
Well, we are to transform that.
Okay.
Accept it where it is, see it for what it is, and then take our stand. No, I think we can leave the animals alone.
No, I mean, in terms of, like, I think it's in here also that you mentioned this way, in terms of Polly, that in terms of getting in touch with his feelings or stuff, needs to be more instinctive.
That's related, but that's really a secondary point. The secondary point here is, what is your relationship to evil? I mean, the main point is, what is your relationship to evil? I don't know if you've known anyone who has been abused, particularly as a child. What's the first thing a child says? It's my fault.
It's my fault.
Mm-hmm. Mommy and Daddy got divorced. It's my fault. Inevitably. And I think that is the psychological starting point, if you have a hard time grasping this. That when things go against us, our first inclination, certainly as young people, is to take responsibility for it. Now, in a way, this contradicts everything Jung has set up to now. Because at what we're looking at is, what things should you not take responsibility for? Which is awkward in our time, because people are so unwilling to take responsibility for anything. But that's not the same. This is applicable to people who are already capable of responsibility, but who take on too much. And it's what the Freudians would call, it's against what the Freudians would call identification with the aggressor. that you tend to adopt the value system of the persecutor rather than stand up for your own understanding of truth. Well, yeah, what the president says is right. That's the simplest version of it. How many people think like that?
Now, how are you fitting that idea together with what you had said before?
Well, when there's an overpowering experience, which is harmful, the tendency of a young person is to blame themselves for it. And that just sets up this attitude of trusting the standpoint of authority, whether it's right or wrong. And this is the foundation of fascism. How do so many fascistic governments exist? Why do people take it? Well, here's the reason.
Because our idea of God is for Yahweh.
Right, right, right. Okay, so let's look now at some of the finer points. First of all, I'll give you the page numbers if you want to read. I'll try to do this quickly. Page 24, this is in Transformation of the God Image. A very important preface. He makes the point, if you're not offended, you don't understand it. So don't be shocked if you're offended. You should be offended. This goes contrary to everything we have been taught.
And if you're not offended, don't read this. Doesn't he help us with that? If you don't read this book because you're not in this
space. He might say, I don't remember.
I remember laughing at that.
Yeah.
This book isn't for you, stop.
The other thing he talks about very briefly is the motto to the book, which translated is, I grieve for you, my brother. Which is actually... I forget where it's from. It's an Old Testament quote. He doesn't say, maybe he does say, what does he say? Yeah, 2 Samuel 1:26. The story is, Jonathan is friends with David and Saul. Saul is the old king, David is his son, the new king. The spirit has left Saul and gone into David. Jonathan is the friend of David. Let me get this straight. Jonathan is the son of Saul and David's friend. So Saul, David, Jonathan is Saul's son, and David and Saul, David and Jonathan are friends. Old king has power has left the old king. The power is now in the new king David. And Saul goes to battle, and Jonathan abjures his love of David and goes with his father, Saul, and is killed. And Jung takes that as a metaphor for our time, that we are between two epochs, a Saul epoch and a David epoch, or that Saul personifies the old epoch where religious experience was taken to be religious knowledge, and where authority was trusted. And David is the new king, where we know that we can interpret our religious experience and that we have a right to our own judgment vis-a-vis any power of an authority figure. So that's the main shift between two epochs. And Jonathan can't make that shift, and he dies. And so Jung is saying, very obliquely, there are two kinds of people. Those who can follow me, and those who can't. And those who can't, I feel sorry for you. It's very oblique. But the reason he makes it so oblique is that he doesn't want to hurt people who can't make this transition. you know, you will pull the rug out from some people if you stress this. And Jung is very careful not to do that. I think now maybe, I wonder if he would be as careful now, because the world has gotten so much more complicated. The way Edinger takes, this I think is the difficulty in understanding this. This material is really meant to help us understand how to help people who have been abused. But it also has enormous theological implications. And that I think what's so confusing here is realizing Jung is talking on two levels all the time. He's talking clinically and he's talking theologically, both at the same time. So if we take this clinically, it would be a metaphor. The book of Job is a metaphor for helping people overcome trauma. And Edinger lays it out, as he always does, very nicely, 1, 2, 3, 4, on page 29. And he calls the book of Job, or Jung's working with Job, a record of a Job archetype. And there are four stages in the Job archetype. One, there is an encounter between the ego and a greater power. So that would be rape, beating, emotional violation, physical violation, sexual violation.
What did you call it?
An encounter between the ego and the greater power. See, apropos your question, yes, the greater power can be dark. And this is about those experiences when the greater power is dark. Second stage is a wound or a suffering of the ego results. So you're wounded by a violent experience. He doesn't say here exactly, but he will get to it. Let me just throw out. What is so weird about these experiences? When the people dream of who it is that wounded them, very often they dream that it's God who wounded them. That's the clinical basis of this. And some of you, we did this in a whole course, and I don't want to spend that much time on it, but I brought a dream along of a fellow who was physically abused. And the abuser was Victor the Russian. I don't know if anyone remembers that. We talked about that. And Victor the Russian had been in power for 2,000 years. That's an image. That's the shadow of the God image that the unconscious portrayed as the wounder in that young boy's physical beatings as a child. I know it's bizarre, but this is what you have to get your head around. Interestingly, I think I can say it because the dream is 30 years old. He's not a client of mine, and since I've met the dreamer, and the guy was a professor at Yale Divinity School. So you can see what he's working out was this issue of evil. Somehow, I guess if I tried to explain it, it's the shadow of our value system that gets acted out in violence. And then the unconscious personifies that as the shadow of our God image, or in this case, Victor the Russian would be the shadow of our image of God, which has ruled for 2,000 years. That's the way you see it. Now, it usually isn't just God that does it, but there's some quality of the image that symbolizes the injury that is associated with God. Is this making sense?
So you're saying the shadow of our value system can be acted out.
It's what's acted out.
Is acted out by people and the
in the violence.
The victim somehow recognizes that.
The unconscious of the victim knows that this is the shadow of the value system coming out through that person. I mean, it really, you know, as I said, if you're not offended, you're not getting this. That means somehow that our understanding of God sets it up for people to be abused. These are the hard facts that Jung is looking at. I don't know how it sets it up, but the idea again is that the abusive moment is symbolized as an attack from an image, and characteristics of that image tie it to God. 2,000 years in that case.
So are you saying that the same thing could have happened, but without these images, or maybe different images, it would not have been experienced as abuse necessarily?
No.
I'm thinking of how the imagery that we have, you're saying, sets up the abuse.
Oh, because that our image of God has a shadow which is not included in our understanding of God. And so that allows that shadow to operate independently. And somehow it infects the body politic and it attacks weak people. And those weak people then act it out.
Oh, I see.
I mean, that's my attempt to make it make sense of it. I'm not sure it does make sense.
It drives the perpetrator.
Right. Mm-hmm. What of God that we don't recognize drives the perpetrator? That's Jung's implication.
And then are you saying the psyche of the person injured recognizes that?
The psyche recognizes it.
So it's an unconscious.
It's an unconscious formulation. The conscious personality would never say this. But the imagery that the psyche throws up, and in the dream, maybe I should have brought it along, it was just so powerful. In the dream, Victor the Russian had a poison. And Victor the Russian, every 2,000 years, had to reincarnate himself. And he reincarnated himself by giving somebody the poison. I mean, think about that. That the evil is propagating itself by always creating a new form. And in the dream, the dreamer doesn't take the poison, but starts turning into Victor the Russian anyway. So that it was successful. And as I say, it's not my client. A friend of mine I was working with, and we were talking about the dream, and my thought was he should have taken the poison but not drunk it. To not take the poison is to deny that the experience was poisonous. And to deny that the experience is poisonous is how evil propagates itself. When we deny that it was evil, when we deny that an evil thing happened to us, we become the perpetrator for the next generation. Look at Israel. To take it is to acknowledge I have been abused, and this is evil. To take it is the Job position. Job took the poison. He admitted he was suffering, but he maintained his innocence, and that would be parallel to not drinking the poison. So you take it, and then you have to transform it. Okay, so that's the encounter, the wound. Now, the third stage, the ego persists in scrutinizing the experience in search of its meaning. It will not give up in despair or cynicism. In other words, you say, God, I have been wronged and I need an answer. And I am not stopping my accusations until the answer comes. Tried discussing that in a seminary. Will not give up in despair or cynicism, but perseveres in the assumption that the experience is meaningful. See, it is not cynicism, and despair cannot be the final word here. Also, denial and acceptance of responsibility cannot be the final word. But consciously bearing the pain in knowledge of your innocence is the way to go.
Did Job ultimately find the meaning of the experience?
Well, If you take the book of the Bible as one person's experience, yes. That would be the birth of Christ. Yeah. What?
Only because he succumbed to the pressure, and but what it did was just create the split for God. So the transformation wasn't complete.
Wasn't complete.
So had he hung in there,
yeah,
it could have been
perhaps
united.
But I think you have to look at the stage of history that it was written in. At that point, the ego wasn't strong enough to do that. But we are now facing that next chapter.
But at least he did get to the point. He took the steps to the point where he didn't accuse God. I mean, he did say he didn't end up in cynicism himself.
Right.
And anger.
Right.
He didn't violate his own soul.
Mm-hmm.
He did stand up to him and say,
as long as he humanly could.
I see who you are, and mm-hmm. Now I'm saying no more. Mm-hmm. I've already said it.
Mm-hmm.
So he did take a step, and it was a progress.
Mm-hmm.
And mightily.
He was broken by the experience, but that wasn't his problem. Because he recanted by the end of the book. Job recanted by the end of the book. And Jung's point of view is a human individual can only bear so much.
Yeah.
And so that is not a statement about Job.
Under torture, you'll say anything.
You'll say anything, right.
To make it stop.
Right, right. And that's, so the traditional interpretation is you see,
God
and Jung is,
best.
Yeah, God knows best, and Jung is saying no. He was broken, but that is nothing to do with Job. That is the bestiality of God breaking a human being. That is no moral victory for God. That is crime. Shall we have a stretch? And
isn't he supposed to have been the first one who actually began the process of individuation?
Yes.
Because he was the very first one to turn and face it.
Right.
And so it's not irrelevant how it ended, but what matters most is
right.
that the moment provoked the individuation process.
Right, and I think also, you know, where we are today, it set up the process that we're still dealing with.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And the original book of Job, the way it got rewritten, where God then sent him four wives and, you know, tripled his money, but that was put in later as a way to promote the story that you were saying earlier, that God knows best.
Mm-hmm.
And when you allow God to know best, look at all he'll do for you.
Mm-hmm.
You mean the books of the Bible were edited?
take a break. All you heathens.
And throw it up.